I'll briefly introduce myself. A.J. Roberts. I also work with Reasons to Believe. My talk is going to be vastly different than the one that you just heard from Fuzz. And I would link it in this way to what we do at the interface of science and Christian faith, that many of the people that we encounter in our lives as Christians who are also scientists, we may be the reason that they choose to believe. So the way that we live in society and the way that we image God to one another and the way that we image creation care is all extraordinarily important. And so I hope to raise some concerns about human genome editing in light of that. How many of you, by a show of hands, were in Doug's workshop on Friday afternoon? Not very many. Okay, so I was hoping that more of you would have been there, and I'm actually not going to give you a whole lot of information about CRISPR-Cas9 system itself, just a brief introduction to that. So it's actually a system that is RNA-mediated gene editing, and it was brought to the forefront by work done in collaboration between Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna with Max Planck and UC Berkeley, respectively, in 2012. And what these women did is they showed that it was a programmable single-strand guide RNA that could be fused to an RNA that interacts with the Cas9 endonuclease protein from bacteria that could target DNA in a site-specific manner that was dictated by the sequence of the guide RNA that could be engineered to will. Now, prior to their work, gene editing had been possible through other methods, such as talons and zinc fingers. But these were very prohibitive for widespread use because of their complexity and the difficulty in engineering them and implementing them, and the cost. Those certain types of techniques for a single type of edit would be in excess of $5,000. In contrast, CRISPR-Cas9 technology is extraordinarily cheap. You can buy a kit on the internet for $130. It's relatively simple, it's fast, and it's widely accessible. And just for those reasons alone, it's already being used by tens of thousands of researchers to modify cells, plants, other organisms, and even human embryos. So the editing mechanism, basically there are two types that you can consider when you think about the applications of CRISPR-Cas9. The one on the left, the guide RNA is setting down on a specific site of DNA, and the Cas9 endonuclease is cleaving both strands of DNA, creating an open break that then the cell's DNA repair mechanisms kick in to join the ends in a non-homologous fashion. And this frequently results in the deletion or the insertion of a single nucleotide or possibly two. These deletions or indels can result in loss of function or even sometimes gain of function. A second use is to introduce the CRISPR-Cas9 into the cell of interest, in addition to a DNA that's been constructed according to your desire, a gene of interest or a gene that has a correction for a mutant allele that's present in the organism's genome. And so by cleaving the RNA, by cleaving the DNA with the endonuclease and having present a DNA fragment with homologous flanking sequences to the break, you can have homologous recombination, and it can result in repair of an allele or introduction of new genetic information. That's it to the extent of how much I'm going to cover CRISPR-Cas9. All the rest I'm going to talk about are applications. So in organisms, in the lab, and actually those that can be released into the environment, it's a powerful tool for assessing the development and tissue-specific regulation of different cells and different organs' development. But we can also build new designer organisms, such as bacteria, insects, crops, and animals. And in these, we can express new or improved proteins. We can create organisms or crops that are disease resistant. And we can also modify proteins in such a way that we can take an animal model and make it more susceptible to human pathogens and use it as a disease model for testing, prophylaxis, and other treatments that have been enigmatic to our current research because we don't have any viable ways of testing this in living entities. So in application to humans in specific, there are both somatic and germline type mutations that we could talk about or modifications. In the somatic cells, it can be useful in treating some incredible diseases and disorders genetic diseases and disorders and congenital diseases such as Duchenne muscular dystrophy, hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, and cystic fibrosis, just to name a few. All of these are monogenic diseases, so you just have to go in and fix one gene, and you can eradicate the disease. There are researchers at the University of Pennsylvania who have passed recently NIH RAC approval to do clinical studies addressing modification of T cells in the fight against cancers. They've been approved to do the study in 18 patients at three different sites addressing sarcoma, myeloma, and melanoma. They still have to receive FDA approval, but their experiments are relatively low risk in the sense that they're removing the T cells from an individual through the CRISPR-Cas9 modifications. They're changing those T cells at three different locations and then reintroducing the T cells back into the recipient. So the Cas9 system is being used in a very limited cell type with delivery quite efficient in vitro. It can also be used for infectious diseases that are persistent in individuals, viruses such as HIV, herpes zoster, and hepatitis viruses B and C. The CRISPR-Cas9 can be introduced into cells that express viral proteins, and it can actually target the DNA that's associated with the virus or DNA that's associated with cellular receptors for the virus, making cells less susceptible to virus. And this work's actually being done in HIV already. In addition to somatic modifications, there are human embryo experiments that are underway and some that have been published already, both in non-viable and viable embryos. There's a group in London and Francis Crick Institute headed by Kathy Nyakin that's actually been granted permission by the UK government to examine a string of different proteins necessary for normal human development, hoping to identify both abnormal and human development in the human embryo. She plans on carrying those experiments out to day 7, but UK law prohibits her from carrying them out past day 14, which is when the neural crest begins to form. So as you can imagine, when we start talking about modification of human cells, somatic and especially germline cells, that someone along the line, once we get the system tweaked and efficiently applicable, can envision designer babies or perhaps some form of molecular eugenics. Now, I would say that this probably isn't likely as far as widespread use because of the expense, the extreme amount of work that would go into modifying it, and the inefficiency of these types of modifications, not just in vitro, but in vitro fertilization. This certainly should raise ethical questions for us, and in some countries, there's absolutely no regulation that modifies, that restricts the use of this type of system for human embryo modification. Some countries, like Germany, absolutely prohibit it with criminal penalties associated with it. It can be done under high scrutiny in some dedicated laboratories in Germany, but other countries like China and India, there is no restriction whatsoever, and yet we need to be aware that once we start introducing modifications into the human germline, that it can enter the population and affect us all globally, regardless of what our country boundaries are. So concerns and cautions, backing it up to sort of an animal and a crop level away from the human concerns at this point. CRISPR-Cas9 technology can be implemented to eradicate or modify disease vectors. Sounds like a great idea, right? Let's get rid of some mosquitoes and ticks that carry disease. But it actually leads to one of the biggest fears surrounding CRISPR, which is the creation of something known as gene drives. And gene drives are unlike normal sexual reproduction and the spread of a trait through a population through normal reproduction. Gene drives actually create a system where you've introduced a change with CRISPR-Cas9, and in addition to the change that you've introduced into the gene, you've also introduced the capability of that change to cut the DNA in the heterologous allele and copy the DNA of your new insert into the gene through homologous recombination. And so now you become homozygous in every progeny for the gene that you've introduced. So it can spread rapidly through a population, and you can imagine that although you're targeting a particular organism for a particular change, due to our limited knowledge of other organisms, both fit within the ecological niches, the relevance of that organism to other organisms, or even a particular gene modification within an organism to other functions that might take place in the organism's development or reproduction, we could actually create a more vulnerable species. And we could relatively easily, whether intentionally or unintentionally, engineer a species into extinction. So DNA editing in the wild may have irreversible and unforeseen ecological outcomes. So most of you, show of hands, think, let's get rid of mosquitoes. Pretty good idea, right? They're pretty pesky, right? Well, there are 3,000 identified mosquito species to date. And of those 3,000 species, only about 200 are relevant to human health. And actually, if we were to eradicate mosquitoes, even a given species of mosquitoes, if it's the prevalent species in a particular ecological niche, we've seen in previous experiments that it can drop the bird population by up to 50%. And when you think about the mosquito's larval stage, this is also a major food source for many fish and amphibians. So we could drastically have ecological effects that we are unaware of or insensitive to unless we take time to think through these points point by point. Okay, so now back to general concerns that are a little bit more relevant for human genome editing. There is a high off-target site association for the CRISPR-Cas9 technology. What do I mean by that? Well, you have guide RNAs that are moving into specific DNA sequences, right? But they can also bind with less fidelity to sequences that are similar. So if you have one or two nucleotide substitutions or even similar sites, the human genome is over 50% repetitious DNA, right? So you could have multiple sites that are relevant to one specific guide RNA. And in vitro, when you're working with differentiated cells, the off-target hits are only about 0.1%, or somewhere up to 5% sometimes. But if you work in human embryonic stem cells, or in human embryos, as the Chinese group has done, they find that their off-target hits can approach 60%. Mm-hmm. That should raise concern for all of us. So there's also the challenge of efficient delivery to specific tissues or cells. If you don't do the modification at a zygote level, then what you're actually needing to do is to target the CRISPR-Cas9 system, usually through a vector-mediated delivery device like a virus, into specific cells where you want to do the genome modification. So you can envision hepatic cells if you're trying to cure some form of liver-associated disease, cardiac cells if it's heart disease. So there's a challenge for efficient delivery to specific tissues and cells that's non-trivial. Now, we can also modify. A group in Boston has indicated that they can modify the Cas9 by 3 or 4 amino acid substitutions and actually increase the fidelity and the specificity while maintaining efficiency. They've actually claimed undetectable hits on off-site targets. While that should be somewhat reassuring, and it's great for increasing specificity in lab experiments, but it should also raise concerns over the limit of detection. Are they really screening the entire human genome for each experiment when they're making a modification to a single gene? Even if they are doing this through whole shotgun assembly approaches, we know that there are hundreds of thousands of gaps in every attempt to sequence the human genome with a single experiment using whole shotgun assembly approaches. And although they were able to increase the fidelity and reduce the off-target hits to less than their limit of detection, it wasn't true for all of the guide RNAs that they selected. It was template specific. So despite publications since 2004 that report the completion of the human euchromatic genome sequence, about 10% of our genome is still absent from the human reference genome. This is either because it's been unsequenced or unassembled. Large portions of this information, 5% or greater, is in the centromeric sequences, the alpha satellite sequences, but it's also in the acrocentric short arms of chromosomes, in telomeric sequences, and in enigmatic sequence duplications that are quite hard to fill in through different techniques. There's also a high level of person-to-person variability. Person-to-person variability, for instance, in the HLA allele, can be 10 to 15%. but in some portions of chromosome 15, over a 3 million base pair sequence of human DNA, there can be up to 50% variation from individual to individual. So CRISPR-Cas9 modification really needs to be considered at an individual level, not as a one CRISPR-Cas9 construct fits all. And the ENCODE project and continued research indicates that non-coding RNAs, which are more than 90% of the human genome, are actually likely to be associated with those diseases that are not monogenic. And so what does that mean? We need to not just be concerned about off-target hits in exons or in genes that we know, but in the entire non-coding space of the human genome, because changes to those areas, whether intended or off-target, could result in human disease. So this is just a snapshot I pulled off the Genome Reference Consortium site last night, and it's to indicate to you, in the column over there on the left, you can see there's one box that's checked that says GAP 514. So this is just the euchromatic sequence that's out there in the human reference genome, build 38. There's still 514 gaps of unknown length, and you can see that they span through all of the 23 chromosomes, both sex chromosomes included. So the gaps are of various types, but now I'm going to move on to what I call hubris in the human genome. The chromatin remodeling and differential expression of genes during development in various tissues and under varying physiological or environmental conditions makes the human organism extremely complex and dynamic on a genetic level. Germline modifications, as I've already pointed out, affect future generations. Yet, if evolutionary biologists are right and horizontal or lateral gene transfer occurs in mammals and humans, as in bacteria and simple eukaryotes, changes to somatic cells may have generational consequences as well. So even if we back up from humans and we consider how much we don't know about other organisms, if we even consider the most simple bacterial cell that has identified 473 genes, of those essential 473 genes, 149 of them are of unknown function to us. So that's one of the most well-studied bacterial species, and yet we still don't know everything that's going on there. So we need to be extremely careful in how we make decisions. And yet John Pollock, a philosopher and sometimes known as the father of defeasible reasoning, who was active in artificial intelligence research, puts it this way: we must be able to make informed choices in a climate of prevailing ignorance. That's true of each of us every day. And I would caution that our confidence in what we know and what we can do needs to be tempered by the truth of how much more we still do not understand. Our overconfidence can be equated to children playing with matches. It's not too hard to imagine or far-fetched to think that it could result in something that we won't be able to control. In this case, ignorance is not bliss. And you might keep in prayer those folks that are fighting fires in California right now. It's in 30,000 acres and only about 10% contained. So points for our ethical consideration. I think I've driven this point home a little bit already. Naivete or overconfidence and accidents are not trivial issues when we talk about genome editing, whether it's of another species or of our own species. In some parts of Europe, the genetic engineering is illegal outside of professional facilities. But extreme differences exist, even in our own country, between government versus private pursuits. So although the NIH puts bans on federal funds being used for human embryo modification, there is no such restriction on private funds. The only restrictions that would come into play is if those privately funded projects wanted to move into clinical trials, then they could also be regulated by the FDA. But once we've crossed the line and modified the human genome, we've affected all future generations. And those individuals who choose to make those changes affect generations without their consent. And I think that this is a really pivotal point that's made by C.S. Lewis, perhaps far better than I'm able to make it today, in a very short book called The Abolition of Man. It's only three chapters long. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it to you. I've used it many times in book discussion groups at Yale and elsewhere. So I'm going to end with what I call faith tempering unrestrained editing. We, as Christians who are also scientists, need to think about what our role is in light of what the scripture tells us about who we are and why we're here. So the Judeo-Christian scriptures make it clear that as those made in the image of God, we've been given a dominion and stewardship of creation. In addition to that, we've also been given the model and command to serve one another in mitigating aspects of evil and human suffering. So if we consider those two points, we ought to use CRISPR-Cas9 technology to help care for creation, to steward creation, and to mitigate human disease. But scripture also makes it clear that we fail to acknowledge God, choosing to abandon our honored yet humble place as steward creatures to rather be like gods and manipulate the creation for our own desires. So how do we balance our rightful place as stewards endowed with the image of God without overreaching and presuming godlike privileges? I think the way we do that is by constantly and humbly acknowledging our Creator, that we are creatures, and realize that we are never given dominion over each other, nor over our own genomes. We are only given Jesus' command and model to love and serve one another. So while there's still so many technical challenges that need to be overcome experimentally to use CRISPR more effectively and efficiently, now's the time to really discuss policy and regulatory issues. And I think every scientist needs to be in these discussions, and I think we as Christians need to bring the Christian voice and the Christian moral perspective of both creation and humanity to bear in these conversations. I've written quite a bit more about this. You can read some of my articles at Reasons to Believe, and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
So this is a discussion we had at my school in our capstone course for biochemistry. And just to frame the conversation, are we talking about CRISPR-Cas9 specifically, or are we talking about the potential to edit genomes at all? Because something that we settled on was, like, if we could do this perfectly and eliminate Tay Sachs, and our goal was to get a perfect model to eliminate diseases, then we need to continue researching this direction. But if it's just CRISPR-Cas9, then we have to be very, very careful because of its limitations.
So all of the technologies for gene editing have limitations. None of them are 100% efficient or specific.
Theoretically, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so... So I think that there was a summit that met last December that actually was an international summit, although not really what represented very well by diverse countries. And they came up with a series of guidelines, and they absolutely agree with what you said you and your colleagues came up with, that research at a basic science level should continue. But there should actually be a moratorium on modifying the human genome at the germline level until we basically overcome all of the specificities that are inhibitory at this point. Perry, did you have a question?
Oh, my 12-year-old got a new toolbox for his birthday, and he wants to work on your Ferrari.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Just more than just a comment. You know, as a father of two IVF kids, it does become expensive to do some of this, but I also wonder, going forward, if this does become very good, could insurance actually drive this to produce healthier offspring?
Certainly the potential for there is that. Kevin, I'm going to ask you first, and then I'll get to Wayne.
I liked your talk.
Thank you.
I was thinking here, you didn't really delve into the ethical issues, but if we assume that in 5 years' time this technology matures and addresses a lot of concerns about the vector and efficiency and everything else, to my way of thinking, the ethical issues that are on the table are actually non-distinct from what was visited in the 60s with IVF.
Sure.
It's just when does the human identity actually happen, and that. So I'm trying to think of something that's actually unique in this discussion, or if we're, harkening back towards some of the earlier questions, we're just talking about a different application.
We are talking about only a different application, yet we're talking about an application that is widely accessible to almost anyone with even basic research tools. So maybe they're not going to be carrying things into IVF into modifying the human genome, but they could certainly modify an organism that would have devastating environmental impact if it wasn't modified correctly.
Yeah, I was trying to constrain my question more to the application to humans.
Right.
But like for PGD and IVF, right, I mean, you're choosing, where to move forward. You also have like extra embryos that are then That's
right.
One's still there, and so like all the different issues are basically the same, just a different tool. So would you agree with that statement, or do you think that there is something else there?
No, I agree with that statement, although I would say that until we get the CRISPR-Cas9 finely tuned, and until we actually get the ability to render a complete human genome, that we should not be taking those steps with CRISPR-Cas9, because it's more efficient than those other types of gene editing, even in its present state, as far as like getting it in. But the potential for off-target sites could be fairly devastating. And again, because it seems to have a greater capacity for actually hitting the DNA target than the other like talons or zinc finger modifications do. So, yep. Yes.
Yeah, in terms of stewardship, I was thinking when you were talking about the disease vectors and so forth, maybe that would you agree with something more like a kind of carrot and stick approach to things? So encourage the organisms to go in a direction that is more favorable, but not just try to say that the only good mosquito is a dead one.
Right, right. So yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a fair point to bring up. There are some modifications that are being done in the Anopheles mosquitoes now to try and curb malaria, and they're not trying to wipe out the mosquito population. They're trying to make the mosquitoes resistant to malaria themselves so that they can no longer be a functional vector. In other cases, there's a UK company that's doing genetic modification of male mosquitoes and releasing them, and the modifications in those mosquitoes are actually resulting in the death of all progeny of those mosquitoes that mate. The mosquito can't develop past the larval state to the adult state. And so that has the potential to be more devastating, I think.
Two more questions.
Are there any mechanisms in dealing with China and India, the political
well,
ways?
That's above my pay scale, but yes. No. But there are. I mean, you know, there are international panels, and then there are actions that our State Department can take as far as treaties and things to that effect that govern our public and international behavior.
This is a naive question, perhaps, but to an outside observer, can this kind of gene editing be clearly distinguished from, say, a natural mutations?
No. You mean if I were to come across a modified organism and
yes.
sequence its genome, would I know whether it's been modified in the laboratory or modified by nature? No. Unless it has a totally foreign gene in it, but yeah.
Let's thank AJ.